It's time for the fastest 15 minutes in the news. This is Dory's Fastest 15.
David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. We're saving the more serious stuff for next hour right now.
Of course it's Fastest 15. And we're going to start with the story about palm, paying with the palm at Whole Foods. You pay, instead of talking to the hand, in this case, you're going to be paying with the palm thanks to a new technology from Amazon. Where they're expanding pay with your hand technology to Seattle area Whole Foods stores. Basically, you give them your hand, kind of like on your smartphone, you give your smartphone your face and the facial recognition software. In this case, they're doing it with your hand. There's a little kiosk there. It scans your hand. Then you enter a credit card. And from that point on, your credit card is connected to your hand. So before you shout Mark of the Beast, there's no chip going in that palm. You just got to hold that palm up and pay for it, which, you know, it sounds okay to me. I'm not sure it's any faster than the credit card itself, but, you know, at least this way, if you forgot your credit card or you didn't want to bring your credit card, you know, in your pocket, you just walk to the store and pick it up with a high five. And, you know, and that's thanks to Amazon. Now, Amazon also likes the idea because they want to sell the technology, the patented technology, and have other stores use it, which they would then use to expand the Amazon empire. By finding more about you and connecting your buying habits to places beyond the Amazon footprint. So, you know, I mean, if you're shopping at Whole Foods, Amazon owns that. But if you're shopping elsewhere and they happen to buy this material, then Amazon would be able to take advantage of that information. So, of course, some privacy concerns from organizations have arisen. But I feel like that's obligatory to say about all new technology now. And as someone who values privacy, at the same time, I'm almost at this point where I just feel it's hopeless. You know, it's just everything is, and you know, I resisted the facial recognition software forever. And then I thought, oh, forget it. You know, I'm on my phone. I can talk about some other kind of, and I don't activate the Siri or Alexa or anything else. No smart speakers for me. And yet, if I'm talking about one kind of item, next thing you know, it's popping up all over in the digital ads that I'm looking at. So I feel like whatever privacy I used to have, apparently it's gone. I'm just living through a reality show at this point. Next up in Nevada, a killer says he doesn't want lethal injection. His lawyer says that's a cruel and unusual form of punishment. Please, may I be shot instead? Killer Zane Michael Floyd says he doesn't want to die, and so they're challenging the three drug dealers, claiming they want death by firing squad. And then the federal public defender representing Floyd says this is not a delaying tactic. But of course it's a delaying tactic. The whole point at this point is to try to find a way in court to make it so that they won't be able to shoot him. You know, at this point, you know, when they're worried about this, and they claim that, you know, this is going to hurt. I look at this guy. He's convicted of going into a shopping center, shooting four people and killing them with a shotgun, severely wounding another. And I'm thinking that maybe they, you know, felt like that was a little sore as well. So I'm not saying cruel and unusual, but the fact that somebody might feel a little bit of pain before they go, I don't lose a lot of sleep over that. You know, and I don't think that's inconsistent with valuing life, because the lives you value at that point are the four people who were killed and the fifth who was wounded in the shotgun attack on a supermarket in 1999. You know, so that's where your value is. This guy is just a leech on tax dollars, staying alive for no apparent reason other than to give lawyers something to do and make yet another challenge about lethal injection. And the claim that, you know, a paralysis drug along with fentanyl and what's the other one? So the sedative that they inject for the three drug cocktail. It's just too much for him to take, which is hard for me to buy. And at this point, I just think instead of a firing squad, why not get, you know, do the Rambo thing. Remember in Rambo First Blood 2, he just picks up the rocket launcher, blows the guy up. You know, I mean, you're not going to feel much from that. Just get the biggest possible firearm there and blow him up. And I can't complain about that. Next up, and this is on the good news front, there's a new white paint out, according to the Smithsonian Magazine. And the white paint, they think, will be able to replace air conditioning at one point. And I think that's really exciting because, remember, the environmentalist, I'm trying to remember his name. He's the European guy. When we talk to Todd Myers later on the show, I'll remember. But I think it's Bjorn Lomborg. You know, he pointed out that if you painted the roofs white in many urban areas, it would reflect enough sunlight so that you would lower the temperature and things would get better in terms of the impacts of global warming. And his argument is to tackle some of the impacts more cost efficiently and then use your resources better to improve the environment. And of course, he's condemned for that because, you know, there's a political agenda attached to the environmental movement so that inefficient ways of addressing environmental concerns are rewarded and applauded. Politicians, I mean, it's Earth Day today, and how many headlines have we had from local and national and federal officials and international officials making various promises with deadlines that go well beyond their retirement date when it comes to, you know, Joe Biden, you know, promising various things, the Washington legislature, we're going to go gas free, no more gas cars in 9 years, you know, and I guess if we don't make it there, well, then we'll readjust. Governor Inslee saying, hey, look, other states do what I want our state to do. And there's hardly a blip on gas prices. And we know that's not true. I mean, it's ridiculous. But, you know, they make these claims, they get the headline, they make the promise, they get credit for the promise, and it's a political promise. So politically, they get to say, look, I did something. And the reality is not so good. And if you ever watch the show Yes, Prime Minister, which I highly recommend, even if you're not that keen on politics, but you're disinterested in watching hours of C-SPAN and you just want to know how things work, I think it's worth it. It's an old British sitcom. And there's various episodes where the civil service and the public are kind of at war with the politicians and back and forth. And there's that one point where the civil service is asking the politician what he wants. And the politician, you know, says, well, I want to do something about the environment. And they say, well, do you want to do something about the environment or do you want to appear to do something about the environment? And he says, well, I want to appear to do something. Obviously, we can't actually do anything. And that's where we fall so often. But it's not acknowledged. Instead, we pretend it's something else. So the Smithsonian points out this new white paint innovation, which, you know, is inspiring for a number of different ways. They've created this paint that's ultra white, and it actually cools surfaces around, not just that have been painted, but the surfaces around it. And they think it could keep surfaces up to 19 degrees Fahrenheit cooler than their ambient surroundings. And you'll be able to purchase it within the next year or two. They think it would dramatically cut reliance on air conditioners. And it only absorbs about 1.9% of sunlight, whereas commercial paint absorbs 10 to 20% of sunlight, according to the Purdue mechanical engineering professor and one of the study's co-authors looking at this paint. And, you know, what's cool about that is think about in some of these areas where electricity prices are going up. And part of that's by ridiculous political demands and decisions. You know, if you can create something like this and people can paint the roof and reduce the demand, you know, that's savings on the electrical grid. That's savings on their bill. And it's all for a coat of paint. Not a bad way to go. So the paint itself, it sounds like kind of it's a miracle substance. It sounds awesome. You paint your roof. It works like an air conditioner. You know, I don't know who wouldn't do it if it were out there. I'm sure it's expensive paint, but as any of you have tried to put in air conditioning in your home, you know, that's not cheap either. And then there's the consistent electrical bills. So, you know, you paint the roof of your house and you'd end up with a much cooler house. And this has these great applications. So you look at this, and when we talk with Todd Myers about Earth Day coming up, I think at 2:30 today, one of his passions is pointing out how the free market is doing more to solve environmental challenges than various government regulations. Because government gets into this thing where there's a political advantage to one position or another for various friends, and you can subsidize your political allies. And so they get committed to addressing problems one way. And it doesn't matter if it's the most efficient way. You know, it's the way that they're absolutely committed to because they get payoffs, you know, and they get control. But something like this happens where you've got people just experimenting. They've created a new product. It's going to go and it's going to be, you know, basically a paint version of air conditioning, a competitor. And it has all this potential. And it's a market-based address of these various concerns that could end up reducing, you know, the burden on electricity, reducing the use of air conditioning, and reducing the need for, you know, say coal-fired plants creating electricity. You know, so it's just a huge boost, and it's just one story among many, many, many stories about market forces jumping in and doing things and individuals doing things to help the environment, which I think is a more exciting approach to Earth Day rather than, you know, the usual headline of politicians are going to pass something and it's got deadlines here in 5 to 10 years. It's going to be big. Let's congratulate them for it. And once you've given them that, you've given them everything because what they needed was the headline so that they can then put it in their brochures and their reelection materials and talk about how environmentally friendly they are. And then they'll congratulate themselves. You know, second probably only to Hollywood in terms of self-congratulation for minimal accomplishment. And then that's where we land on there. Next up in Britain, things are opening back up, but they're having a problem because while bars and restaurants and pubs are opening back up and people have been fairly excited about that, the problem has been they don't have bathrooms. The bathrooms aren't open. The ones that are open are they've got very long lines, queues, as they say, and they're getting an increasing problem with, how do we put this for a family show, with the street of loo. Remember in the old days when they just have trenches in the middle of the streets, so, you know, animal and human waste would just be there and you just couldn't imagine the stench of the old West towns. Well, these towns, you know, London's a pretty modern town and it's paved, but when nature calls, people are going to find a way to go. And if there's no toilets around, this is what happens. And so it's become a bit of a nightmare there. By the way, even with that, however, there's a new app that started up. Two brothers ended up, you know, free market once again. They see a problem. People aren't able to find a bathroom. It's driving them crazy. They're ending up in an alleyway or with friends holding up a blanket, you know, to hide them as they're, you know, on the street somewhere. And so they started an app for locations. Not location, location. Get it? So you find a bathroom that you're allowed to use using this, and people have been using it galore. Creators of the site estimate last month alone, 10 million people used the service to locate a toilet in London. So, you know, if you think about how bad the pandemic might have been for you, you know, I suppose there's always a way it could get worse. And that would be one of them. All right, now we've got audio of airline pilots. This is from Vice.com reporting on Canadian airlines seeing UFOs, unidentified flying objects. And you can't just dismiss this stuff as the old, you know, cake pan. You throw it up in the air and you catch a quick video, and then it goes on In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy or something. You know, these are pilots reporting strange circumstances, and this is one of them.
Have any targets up here? We just had something go right over the top of us that, I hate to say this, looked like a long cylindrical object that almost looked like a cruise missile type of thing moving really fast that went right over the top of us.
Okay. You know, I don't know about you, but that makes me feel a little strange. I feel like only after a year of pandemic and then crazy election stuff and riots and all the rest, could we have so many different stories about pilots, credible pilots, saying that they've seen strange craft, in some cases dropping down from, you know, dropping down from 41,000 feet up in the air, you know, getting in the way of their aircraft or sailing by their aircraft or breaking speed records and outrunning jets or creating maneuvers that make our own technology look, you know, like the horse and buggy. I feel like only in this context can we ignore news like this. It's like, it doesn't make headlines. People aren't interested. I mean, I see something like this and I'm always like, what? And I feel like I'm one of maybe 1% of the public. The rest just kind of go, nah, whatever. You know, friends have said, oh, it's probably drones, you know, drones of adversaries. It's like, and that's the good news, right? I mean, the best case scenario is that maybe the Chinese or the Russians or the North Koreans have got some drone capabilities that can invade our airspace and outmaneuver us technologically. You know, I mean, think about the implications there. It's not good. Not that there is good. And then when you think, you know, of alien, I mean, based on my extensive knowledge of alien invasion movies, when you have UFOs coming in to take a closer look, it's never good news. It doesn't end well. You know, it tends to have a single day of disaster put on the calendar. And if we're really lucky, you know, COVID-19 is the Trump card. And I don't mean to that in a pun, but it would be, you know, COVID-19 might be the one bug that kills the aliens or something. You know, I think it was Stephen Hawking who put out the information that maybe we should stop sending signals into space because somebody might hear them. And he pointed out that when advanced civilizations and cultures meet less advanced civilizations and cultures, they tend to be less than tolerant. Right. So, you know, so while you might have all the desire in the world to go, you know, meet some friends and let E.T. phone home, it's not that the odds are pretty bad. Right. So anyway, I look at this stuff and I'm fascinated by it. I think the drone explanation makes a lot of sense, you know, because there's a lot of private industry and business that have been working with these with drone technology and flight and unmanned abilities. And I think that makes a lot of sense. But at the same time, the implications there are not good. And I'm just kind of stunned that this stuff still kind of gets buried in the weirdo part of the news where it's kind of like, aha, there's a UFO sighting there, you know. And they're pointing out that most pilots are never going to report the stuff precisely because of that, because they don't want to be sitting there being laughed at and have their careers ruined because they reported seeing something they couldn't identify. So, I every time I see something like that, I'm picturing Jeff Goldblum in Independence Day, you know, just giving that worried look on his face, like, you know, checkmate. It's you know, why are these things appearing in these various areas across the world, and what are they looking at? And so, in Canada, they've got a ton of them. The U.S., we've had a ton of them. There's if you want to read some real weird phenomenon, read about some of the U.S. Navy experiences with these craft. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they are, I guess. Next up, Facebook is going to have a decision soon on whether or not they're going to ban former President Trump permanently based on their much touted board that's set up, their supposedly independent board. Set up to decide, the Independent Oversight Board, to either uphold or reverse their indefinite suspension of former President Trump. Now, you know, various people, mostly politicians, have been saying, well, you know, I'm concerned about Trump, not as concerned about Trump, but I'm concerned about the fate of anybody who's deplatformed. However, he needs a long waiting period because, look, they're blaming him for the violence at the Capitol and so forth. But, you know, I look at that and I think, well, there's been lots and lots of riots and violence around. Is Trump the only politician getting banned permanently? And if not, why not? My own view is it's got rather old fashioned. It's the cure to bad speech is more speech, rather than having places that are supposed to just be platforms stop being publishers and deciding for us what speech we must be protected from and what we shouldn't. But, you know, as I said, I'm old fashioned in that regard. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. Now, We made some news, some big historical news for the state, and that's because the state house passed an income tax proposal. But you might not know it because, for the most part, it is presented as a tax on capital gains, just an income tax on, or rather, a capital gains tax or an excise tax on capital gains. Now, the reality is that the IRS defines the capital gains tax as an income tax. The Congressional Budget Office defines capital gains tax as an income tax. The legislation that enables this tax would have you, if you were subject to it, turn in documents, you guessed it, from your federal income taxes in order to implement the tax. The proponents of the tax, one of the key proponents, Senator Jamie Peterson, called the tax one of the key, most promising ways, I'm paraphrasing, to attain a progressive income tax in this state. So we know that one of the goals of this from proponents is to get a court challenge that might allow a court to throw out about 100 years of precedent and redefine how property is treated according to the state constitution so that they could enable these income taxes, the broader based income taxes. We also know that the revenue departments of 49 other states, that's right, all the other states, treat capital gains taxes as income taxes because they're income taxes. So the IRS, all other states, the Congressional Budget Office, everybody calls it an income tax except advocates in Washington State, who don't want to call it an income tax because it's less popular. And the media in Washington State, for the most part, doesn't call it an income tax because what they'll say instead is, well, critics say it's an income tax, or Republicans criticized it as an income tax, as though somehow the Republicans represent the 49 other states, the IRS, and the Congressional Budget Office, and so forth. I mean, it gets to be absurd at this point. The guru on this issue, the researcher whose expertise I value when it comes to budget issues and particularly this income tax issue, is Jason Mercier, my colleague from my usual job at Washington Policy Center. Jason Mercier is the center director for the Center for Government Reform at Washington Policy Center, and he joins us now. Jason, as always, great to talk to you here on the Dory Monson Show.
Hey, Dave, I appreciate being on with you. And I got to be honest with you, I am exhausted. I'm not sure if I'm exhausted from the nearly seven-hour floor debate on this split up over the last 2 days, or because of just how little honesty was on display during that 7 hours.
And you put it so diplomatically, too, and it reminded me of this is why you're so respected and I'm not. You said at this point it was – for the first time, they were practically lying, you know, but really you could eliminate the practical because at this point, you know, you point out that it's bordering on intentional dishonesty because, as you point out, there's language in the bill that's been added, and you call it a stealth emergency clause. And that clause reads, quote, "The tax levied in subsection 1 of this section is necessary for the support of the state government and its existing public institutions." And from the state constitution, referendums are allowed. That power is reserved by the people, the power of referendum, and it can be ordered on any bill or law or any part thereof passed by the legislature, except such laws as may be necessary for the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, or safety, support of the state government and its existing public institutions. So they lifted that clause, support of the state government and existing public institutions, inserted it into the bill into that, specifically knowing that should kick in the no referendum, so the people can't vote on it, and then they're denying that it's an emergency clause. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, you know, for the last 9 years, this was very first proposed, this income tax on capital gains in 2012. And since then, we've had this game about it being an excise tax, right? Okay, the IRS, the Congressional Budget Office, every other state in the country and every tax professional in the world, maybe they're all wrong and the state of Washington knows something that they don't. But let's just put that aside. I was prepared for that. What I wasn't prepared for was what happened with the emergency clause. And if you recall, this was a very critical point of the debate in the Senate. This passed 25-24 with a one-vote margin only after they removed the emergency clause that would prohibit the right of referendum. And even the sponsor of the bill, Senator Robinson, said that her expectation was if citizens want to exercise their right of referendum, they're going to be able to do that. When it came over to the House, however, and when it came out of the Finance Committee, they didn't use a traditional emergency clause. They didn't advertise it in the title like you usually do. They didn't have it as a separate section like normally happens. Instead, they just buried in the middle of the word a sentence cut and pasted from the Constitution solely to prohibit the right of referendum while denying that's what they were doing.
And there's no other reason for that sentence. I mean, as we've pointed out, what's the growth of this of the state budget over the last, say, 5 years?
Well, I mean, we have seen tremendous growth. If you just look back over the last 10 years, you're going from around a $32 billion budget to what they are about to adopt, a $59 billion budget. You're almost doubling.
Right. So, and then we've got all the key functions of government that are currently funded. And as you point out, you know, the overall budget has nearly doubled over the last several years, and in a relatively short period of time. I mean, the tax revenue is just pouring into the state. We have a growth this year of what did it end up being? Last I saw, it was like almost 8%. Didn't it go over 10 in terms of revenue growth?
Right. We just had almost another $80 million added here in this past month.
Yeah, so it's continuing to grow. And so all the money is there, and then they claim that this bill is necessary for the support of the state government and its existing public institutions, even though all those things are not only funded, they're funded at record levels. So why would you put that in there unless there's only one reason for that clause to be in there, because it's a lie, frankly, and then you put it in there in order to try to signal to the courts, hey, this we've decided not to allow this bill to be subject to referendum. We don't want to vote on this, and that's the only reason. And they're laying down this dishonest political camouflage on it.
Yeah, I mean, let me tell you why this was just so lack of honesty in this debate. The Constitution provides a way, if the legislature doesn't want the people to run a referendum, that they can do that. Right? There is an exception to a right of referendum. You got to be honest about that. You got to say that for whatever reason, this policy we're about to impose is so critical and important, we can't allow any second guessing by the sovereigns of the state. Be honest about that. But what we saw happen is not only did they insert this in the middle of the bill without advertising that's what they were doing, there were multiple amendments to try to clarify and remove that. And it was during that debate where we heard comments about, well, this isn't an emergency clause. We're not trying to do this. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah, you point out in your story in the Washington State Wire that the House rejected the amendment to clarify the bill does not contain the stealth emergency clause. And so time and again, they keep saying, oh, there's, it reminds me actually of a few years ago, about 5 years ago when I was in the legislature, Senator Phil Fortunato had a constitutional amendment to ban income taxes in the state. And across the aisle, they were outraged by Senator Fortunato's bill. And the speaker after speaker, many of whom are in leadership now, were claiming that it was a total waste of time because nobody's talking about an income tax. Nobody wants an income tax of any kind. Then one senator stood up and said, well, I want an income tax. I know nobody wants me to say it. And there's this big groan. And so, you know, here we have an income tax proposal and nobody wants to call it an income tax. Nobody wants to admit it's an income tax. And nobody wants to admit that they inserted this emergency clause in there because they don't want people to vote on it. They want it implemented. And as you point out, the Senate, it passed by one vote. A couple of those votes claimed that this was essential for their support. So now the question is, were they telling the truth the last time? Because the Senate will have to vote on this in order to pass it, right?
Yeah, we're going to about to see if that was an honest debate, because it has to go back to the Senate for concurrence. And if the Senate concurs, they will be concurring on a proposal to prohibit the citizens' right to referendum. So either you believe that the citizens having this right was critical to your vote and important, or you don't. And we're going to know very quickly here in the next few days which of those positions prevails. You know, there was another amendment that they didn't even vote on that really cuts to the heart of this entire issue, because you mentioned the public records showing that the actual goal of this bill is to set up a situation where the state Supreme Court can open the door to a broad-based graduated income tax without a constitutional amendment. So the amendment proposed would have basically allowed everybody to be very upfront, saying, you actually believe this is an excise tax, or you're trying to use this to open the door to a broad-based income tax. Because the amendment basically would have just prohibited the Attorney General from asking the Supreme Court to overturn their prior rulings to allow a broad-based income tax. And that amendment was ruled scope out of order. They weren't even allowed to vote on it.
Amazing. Amazing. And this is what bothers me so much, because we, you know, you uncovered the email of a key supporter saying exactly that, that was the goal of this thing. I've been very frustrated with media coverage of this. I know you were happy. I saw your Twitter account where you're excited about one newspaper, I think it was the Spokesman Review, finally putting income tax in the headline, you know. But if you just think about it from a selling newspaper point of view, income taxes are a big deal. There's all the evidence is out there that the goal of this is to implement broad-based income taxes in the state. And yet it's like pulling teeth. The way it's covered is, well, critics say it's an income tax, even though, as I pointed out, it's not Republicans, it's not critics, it's not the Washington Policy Center, it's the IRS, the revenue departments of the 49 other states. They used to be the Commerce Department of this state, the Congressional Budget Office, and the documents that would implement this law talk about the need for your federal income taxes if you're subject to this tax. You know, so, I mean, the denial that's allowed here, it's just stunning to me.
And it's the bill itself. They play a bit of a game where they use multiple definitions, but if you go back and see how everything is defined, you'll actually see the tax is applied to the income reported to the IRS on your federal income tax return. That's why you're not going to see a cent of this until April 2023 when you file your federal income tax return. I mean, the bill itself makes it clear.
That's right. That's right. So I guess all eyes are on the Senate now. There was 24-25 last time, or 25-24 in favor of passing, but that was with the emergency clause stripped out. Now the question is, will the couple of those votes switch to no, because the House has inserted this emergency clause so that the people won't have the right to vote on this income tax? You know, it's a big question. There's got to be some behind the scenes deals going on right now. There used to be a time when a senator would be pretty mad about getting stabbed in the back by the House like that. The question is, you know, are they going to let the House boss them around now, or are they going to, you know, say, not so fast? We'll see. Jason, as always, really appreciative of your work, and I'd say that even if I didn't work with you, but you just do a fantastic job. Thanks for being on the show.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
You bet. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM.